Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Well, hi, friends. How you doing?
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, everybody. I'm over here working the buttons.
Guys, it's good to be back. I'm sorry I wasn't here last week. Was middle of travel. I went to Thriller Fest, where I was nominated for the ITW Thriller Award for Best Paperback Original. And I'm proud to say the best author won was not me.
Who did win?
I forget. They weren't here. There, I know that because they had somebody else have to go except for them. We can see this here. Actually, Jane Harper won for The Lost Man. And congratulations. You know the concept of imposter syndrome. My joke has been like, I have imposter syndrome. I don't feel I'm good enough to have the real imposter syndrome. So I just sort of like.
So you reject imposter syndrome. When your mind shows up at the door with a gold emblazoned plaque saying, congratulations, you have imposter syndrome. You're like, oh, no. Clearly this is intended for somebody who's actually done enough to merit imposter syndrome.
I was at a cocktail party and there's some writers talking and they're talking. I'm like, I don't want to interrupt. I don't want to go over there. And it was a small party thrown by my publisher. And I'm like, I just don't feel like, you know, I have this sort of like, they're real writers. They're talking. I don't want to bother them, you know? And then I have people call, oh, Andrew Main, you got like this. You know, I just got a big plaque and all that for the number of reads from one of the books and stuff. So it's just a weird sort of thing is that, you never feel like you make it.
Of course.
At least in my case.
That's the betrayal. And I think we've talked about this privately. I don't think we've talked about it on the air. But it's like in the world of TV, first you establish whatever the thing it is you do well enough that you feel like it deserves a TV show. Then you put together the pitch and it gets approved and you're like, oh, my God. And then you do a development reel and it gets approved. You're like, oh, my God, we did it. Now I just have to worry about the pilot. And then you make the pilot and then you worry about whether or not it airs. Then the pilot airs and then you worry about whether or not it's going to be picked up for series. Then you do the series and then you just every year for the rest of your life. Worry about whether or not the series is going to get picked up again. It never ends. It's a never ending cycle.
One step after the next. It's just that you the more you watch like stuff like comedians and cars getting coffee and things like this, and you see that, like, yeah, it's like, oh, so-and-so's a big name, and then that once you're known, you see people like that, and then they don't have a thing. That whole what are you working on now becomes this, you know, the feared question. You know, what are you working on now? It's like, oh, you know. Things and part of the reason is like you get on talk shows when you have stuff going on. If you don't have stuff going on, like now modern big talk shows, they're like, what do they have going on? Nothing. And then it becomes a cycle. So
you'd think that in this era there could be a resurgence of like the, oh, let's just have this random comedian, even if they're not doing anything on, because there's so many talk shows, there's so many places that are doing, but I guess that's podcasting now. Is that new glut?
But no, but there was radio and there's that other stuff. But I'm talking like to the top tier. That's the thing, and that's how it's looked at from the inside. Is that you can say like, you know, going on Joe Rogan may be better than going on a late night show, really. But the perception in the industry is
that you have to have a thing to be plugging. Otherwise, why are you on the Tonight Show, the Late Show?
Yeah, if you're not on the Tonight, if you can't go on the Tonight Show first to go plug it or whatever, it's like, well, geez, you know, that's sort of the thing. But, you know, it's like, you know, you can find interviews now. Like you can be somebody who was like, I watched a guy who was a big name that came out in the Me Too movement on some small tier podcast because they'd have him. They don't care, you know, but that's not like his agent's going, oh, great. We got you that podcast. I'll make sure Netflix sees this so we can get you new work, you know?
Yeah.
So I have a little thing coming up.
Oh, a little thing. I unrelated side story. Man, oh man, I just got back from Comic-Con, and boy, does Comic-Con love Shark Week. You heard of the Shark Week, Justin? Like oh, they had they had banners. People were walking around with these giant foam fangs, giant foam fangers, number one. It was amazing. People love the Shark Week. I'm sorry. What was your thing, Andrew?
Oh, you heard of Shark Week?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Indeed, I have.
Oh, well, cool. I shot a special, which we talked about a year ago. And, you know, the plan was, oh, there, shit, that was me in the promo. Wow. did not know that. First time I've seen the promo package.
Ha!
Yep. So I came up with a crazy idea a year ago, which was like, hey, I wonder, I'm a magician. I like to perform for new audiences. You know, I've performed for, you know, children's hospitals, old folks, cruise ship audiences, resort audiences, TV audiences, international. And I'm like, you know who doesn't get much street magic because they don't have any streets is Sea Life. And probably the one that gets no magic at all might be like sharks or maybe great white sharks.
Fun fact, man. I had this same thought. Turns out fire eating, not great underwater. You can only use magnesium burning underwater, and that's hard to put out with your mouth.
So, see? Andrew, ever the giver, a man who brings his gifts to whoever needs them, what did you do to rectify this situation?
Well, when you talk to the people at Discovery Channel, and it starts off with, like, I'd like to do magic for great white sharks, the idea, the process evolves. What originally started off as an idea I had years ago, like, you know, it'd be really cool, would be, like, to, like, vanish or to try to make myself disappear, like, underwater, but for, like, regular audiences involved sharks and stuff. And then evolved into, like, well, forget the magic trying to do this. What if you just really focus on trying to fool the senses of a great white shark? Like, could – there are some principles in magic that work. We have optic principles or some things that do deceive. Can you deceive a great white shark? And this evolved into the idea of, you know, could I build a suit that incorporated a lot of different technologies to try to make myself invisible to effectively to confuse or make myself invisible to great white sharks, sharks and great whites in general.
And to be clear, like, I assume that the marketing is going to say invisible to sharks or whatever. But in my mind, you're essentially cloaking yourself like the predator, right? So, like, from the shark's perspective, your goal is to look like the predator.
It evolved into a very high tech, sophisticated thing, and then evolving to see what would go through there, including digital mapping, LED stuff, and then it set. Then I evolved into through the special. You'll see me trying to figure out like what's the most practical solution, and you have X amount of time to get this done. And so I try to come up with some stuff and work with shark scientists to figure out like what's the most effective way. So in the special, you're going to see me trying to evolve and design. You can have a very cool concept and figure out what's going to work when you're 80 feet underwater, surrounded by great white sharks and no cage. Which is, spoiler alert, it's where I ended up in the special. So it was an amazing experience.
Did you die? I'm asking Brian for spoilers. Like, did you die?
But the prosthetic is great. It's been great. I mean, did I run back into the cage, which there was none? I had this submersible. Did I not get out? You know, it's a matter of, did the thing work or not? And that's the thing is I can tell you, in working can be like a hypothetical situation. What's the difference? Suit, no suit. No suit. Did I have interactions with great white sharks that I did not want to have happen? have I had too many close encounters? Have I had more close encounters now that I want with very large apex predators, including tiger sharks and great white sharks, because I put myself into situations that were dumb? That's, you're going to see there's a lot to it. So
I assume there's a lot about your upcoming special that we can't talk about in advance. And it kind of makes me want to talk about a project that didn't happen that also involves sharks that we were very close to having happen on one of these networks with the three of us. Mm-hmm. It's a good enough story that I feel like we should share is the pitch that we had for the pilot.
There's been a few.
Well, I'm specifically thinking of...
Okay, but before we move off the special, I do just want to point out again, you know, for everybody, this is something that is really, really awesome. Obviously, we were, you know, in communication while Andrew was shooting it, but there really are kind of two phases to it, just to highlight it. There is the idea of the scientific concept of like, all right, we're using magic principles. How do you go and do it? How do you actually try to fool a shark? And then there is Andrew literally going and putting his money where his mouth is by getting into the water and testing all these different things. And from, I've not seen the special, but I know from the actual process, this was a legit process of trying multiple different versions of this suit and beyond the idea of where these would be, what engineering solutions there would be. There's practical solutions of like, how do we put it in the water? How does it function in the water? Do you move the right way? Like, is it actually doing what it should? There is enough of a problem to do that in the world of magic where you're just trying to fool people from a certain vantage point. It is that much harder of a challenge to then take some of those principles underwater with electronics and have the opposite side of failing be not people being disinterested, bored, or booing, but rather possibly a massive bodily injury from an apex predator.
There, and let me get to the goal of this was this, was that in, were there things that we know in magic, and I've done this before with some research and some other organizations of like, are there things we know in magic that might help other people who are trying to use them for whatever purposes? And my curiosity was for people who are working on shark conservation efforts, because sharks are a vital, vital part of our ecosystem, and many species are threatened, and their habitats, all of their habitats are under danger. And we have a lot of the challenges facing them, and trying to understand them is helpful. And, you know, great whites are amazing. We know so very little about them. And part of the problem is the observation problem. And I was like, well, here are some technology, some things I'm familiar with. Can we apply these and to see if there might be a use here to help us with this to, you know, these creatures are amazing. And, you know, I had a wonderful, amazing experience, you know, in a, I was at the Isle of Jaws. I was, you know, like the fourth person to ever been underwater outside of a cage there, surrounded by great whites, and you see them, to get to see them up close, which is phenomenal. And you realize like, there's so much we just don't know about them, and there's so much we need to protect them. We need to understand them. And one of the tools to be able to do that is to find out how we can observe them without interfering, and et cetera. And so that was the core goal. It was like, what can we figure out? What can we do to ultimately help us understand these things better and, you know, make sure they're going to be around forever.
All right. So let's make sure that everybody takes the time right now to put it in their Google calendar. We are all going to make sure that we tweet the living heck out of all this. Andrew, when are we watching your Shark Week special?
August 2nd, 9 p.m. That's going to be as far as it's Discovery Channel, so I assume it's going to be the same wherever you are in the U.S. I'm not sure. Internationally, it's going to be different times there, but that whole night is going to be great. Isle of Jaws, Blood Brothers. That's a pair of great whites that always hang out together, and it's very atypical behavior for whites. I've seen them in the flesh, by the way. I don't know if
Same day, did you get an autograph? You get a selfie? I guess you did get a selfie with them, because there were cameras around.
Yeah, I did. And then my special, and then I was Prey, which is, it's sort of like people looked at that like, oh, that sounds like your whole experience. And I'm like, yeah, so it's going to be a great night, but Shark Week's fantastic. We've got 20 programs. You've got a lot of great comedians. Rob Riggle's going to be hosting a ton of stuff. It's going to be a great, you know, it's going to go on for like two weeks of content. So just watch it all, but especially mine.
So Andrew Main Ghost Diver is the name of the special. That's if you're looking for your DVR or whatever, make sure that you find Andrew Main Ghost Diver. That is the August 2nd at 9 p.m. a Friday. We got to make sure that we put this one out there, especially on social. You guys know the drill. We thankfully we've been through enough television shows and specials to know what we need to do. Let's make sure we use the appropriate hashtags.
Real quick, like inordinately powerful is the pull of social media. And this is me speaking only for Brian Brushwood. I have nothing to do with Andrew's project or anything. I'm going to say that in my experience, there is an outside level of attention paid to social media responses on stuff. So no matter who it is, no matter what they're saying, a whole bunch of people talking about one thing and then very few people talking about another thing, they're going to look at the one thing. And it might supersede what the actual viewership numbers are and affect things going forward. So you, me, and I can't speak for you guys. I can't speak for the rest of the weird things. Me, personally, I intend to make a lot of noise on all social media about Andrew Main Ghost Diver.
Yep.
Thank you. Do you want to see, we can show for our live audience here, I can show a photo of the latest version of the final suit that's had some modifications since then, but if we can show people what it ended up looking like.
Oh my God.
So.
Doggone it, I'm trying to figure out which DC supervillain you look like.
The Ray from Aquaman, Stingray.
Yeah.
Black Manta.
It's Ghost Diver, guys. Yeah. It's Ghost Diver.
It's Night Monkey.
Yeah, no, it's a Black Manta meet Death Trooper meet Iron Man meet a few things. But yeah, you know, like that weird robot in Star Wars 2 that had where they found the sand crawler. But it's a very the purpose is the materials and stuff, and I'll get into a bit about the special about it, but like, you know, it's not just visual, it's about sound, it's about smell. There's a lot of things, EMF, there's a ton of little things going on, you know, beneath the surface there to try to lower my profile. So it's, you know, I've been describing it, it's like it's an underwater stealth suit. You know, there's a visual component to it, but anyhow, it is it was fun, and it's fun because what's neat is like you feel badass when you're, you know, 80 feet underwater and you're surrounded by great whites and you're wearing this thing, but then you think like, oh no, they can eat through this thing with no problem because it is not it's not like impact armor, and I didn't put any the shark chain mail on because it was going to weigh me down too much. So it's like, oh no, it's like tissue paper to them because it's designed. No.
Yeah, this was designed to do a thing, not to protect a thing.
Yeah,
like that, and they're, oh man, I can't wait to see it. I can't wait for everybody else to see it because if it captures just even a fraction of watching, you know, some of those tech tests and all the different versions of the suit, all the different planning that went into it, it is going to be an amazing television experience.
Can I dangle in front of the Weird Things audience the prospect, the non-zero prospect, that if this special does super well, phone's going to ring and they're going to say, what else do you got? And it is my hope that we could revive an idea we had two or three years ago, I forget when, that was very close to getting piloted, where maybe you know, Andrew's still the star of the Andrew Main Show, but he brings in his two friends.
Oh, I'll put somebody else in the suit, Brian. Next time around, it's you.
No. Okay, so the idea that we had pitched was an old Weird Things idea. We talked about the shark around Florida named Old Hitler, because he had what looked like a swastika tattoo on his fin, very likely was the result of a propeller blade carving him up. But we were talking about the quest for Old Hitler, and our suggestion for a pilot episode was that we build a submersible, a submarine, but we shape it Bugs Bunny style, like a female version of the shark to seduce Old Hitler, and we go try to find Old Hitler. That would be an amazing Shark Week special.
Yeah. We can talk.
It's fine if I'm the only one who feels this way. It's fine.
No, I having gone through the process now of them and having you know, we've had at one point you brought up Old Hitler and we had somebody said, oh, we found out it's been done. And you're like,
it's been done. Like, nobody's made it.
You know, it's one of these things where it's like, you know, there. But yeah, there's other animals, too. I may have had Discovery suggest to me stuff where I'm like, oh, geez, I don't, you know, this is a really great one time thing, guy.
For the record,
There is something magical to Shark Week that, you know, and you guys have both been through the television pitching process, the television production process, that at a certain point is very blue sky. It's a bunch of people sitting in a nice air-conditioned room where they're just tossing out ideas because you're thinking about what's going to be telegenic. And at some point, the beauty of Shark Week is that Andrew's
alone without any protection as sharks are swimming next to him. And it's like, oh yeah, what was really like, we're all high-fiving each other in the brainstorming session about how cool would it look if somebody without protection had a shark right next to him. And then you're there.
With the Great White Side, Andy Casagrande, by the way, amazing shark photographer. He's been in a number of Discovery Channel specials. He's fantastic. So that was making that very clear, is that I did have him, which helped a lot. But yeah, there is that, like, you're on the phone pitching something, like you're pitching a plot line for something, and then you realize, no, this is your life.
Yeah.
This is actually going to be your life. And then you get off the phone and you're like, oh geez, you know, and like, you know, originally I was going to have a shark cage, and then they got banned. And then it was just that the whole evolution from like what was going to be this super safe theatrical illusion underwater to next thing you know, you're getting, you know, Great White's coming up to say hello to you.
Like, it's just one of those things where you just know at the memorial service, no executive's going to step up to the mic and say, yeah, but that pitch was dope. It was a really good idea, like, in the room. Oh,
well,
my
God. You know, we could do a build show that would be around this, you know, like more of doing the different stuff. I mean, that's, you know, for audiences out there, you know, for everybody listening, like, here's the thing is, like, the one of the things about TV is that you watch an hour episode of something, or you watch, you know, 12 episodes of a thing, you know, that Justin worked on, Brian did, or whatever. It's a year, you know, it's a year of your life, and not just the shooting of it, but the planning and the pilot stage. And then by the time something, this was the fastest I've ever had anything go to air. And even the taking as long as it did, the fastest it took to get the green light to go shoot, but you can have stuff that takes forever. And, you know, you reach a certain point where you can go in and you can pitch and people be like, oh, let's hear more. And then it becomes a long process. But, you know, we can talk because, like, I mean, you know, we could do our crazy sort of like build show of us doing stupid stuff.
Well, I'll tell you what. In the meantime,
Brian's already got one called Modern Rogue, I should point out. But we could do a, you know, we'll see.
In the meantime, you can support this show, patreon.com.
I don't do it anymore. It was scary.
You can support the show, patreon.com/weirdthings. Head on over there right now and make sure that you kick in a little coin to keep us loud, live, and independent right here every single Monday. You can make sure that you get the After Things program before anybody else. That is where we talk about not only how we do our independent media careers, but also give advice to anybody that wants opinions on it. And every once in a while, peel off a few opinions of popular media and culture the way that only we can. Head on over there right now. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
You know, it's funny is Bryce put in a thing in the chat section here, which is a link to an article we did about Legend of Old Hitler. That's one of the things that's happened. We've had producers come up to us and go, oh, what about this thing? Or what about this thing? And they send us links and they're from weirdthings.com, you know, our own site. We're like, yeah, no, we know about this because that's our website. Like, oh, wow. Oh,
We definitely like, you know, Jason does the bulk of the research for Modern Rogue Ideas. And, you know, as we have started doing articles at themodernrogue.com, increasingly as he's researching topics, it comes up and it's like the module of authority is something that was created under our umbrella already, or either yep. That or it's a old scam school episode that we did.
Moving away from sharks, which I'm totally cool to do, by the way. Saturday was an anniversary, folks.
Saturday was the day we blew up the moon.
Any of you watch some of the coverage, the 50th anniversary of Apollo?
I didn't. I did watch Apollo 11, the documentary. Of course, we talked about it previously that we watched First Man, which, by the way, showed up on HBO on exactly the 50th anniversary. Nice job, HBO.
Also, Hulu got the new CNN, that CNN documentary that you
oh,
liked.
Oh, wonderful.
Apollo 11.
Is it on Hulu now?
It's
or
on
coming
Hulu
to,
now.
Oh, that's great. Highly recommended. Yeah. Highly recommended.
Thoughts?
Yeah.
Overrated.
It's fake. We never went.
Amazing. The more that you read into that entire process, and the more you watch, especially now, I mean, so much compelling content has been created around it. It's a miracle, you know. And it is in our vantage point at 2019. It seems more and more like the marriage between the apex of the period science and Jackass. You know, like in terms of how dangerous and rickety compared to our modern world, everything sounds.
Of all the presentations, all things done, I do think Apollo 11 may be the best, that documentary, because it's all original footage. They found 65 millimeter footage that had never been publicly shown before. There's editorial choice of where which shots they're going to use, but it's all original footage. All original sound ups. The musical score is different, and every now and then they'll do a graphic to sort of show you what's going on. But it's very much feel, and the 65 millimeter is great because it makes something happen 50 years ago feel relevant and modern. Because just you look at the images, you look at the people, and they feel much more. It doesn't feel like old footage, other than maybe the colors, but it is really, really well done, and you just start to appreciate the size of it, but also this big, huge operation to all of a sudden, here are two guys walking around the surface of the moon, and you look over at the limb and you realize, holy cow, they're 250,000 miles away from Earth, and they've got to get back into this thing, go into orbit, meet up with the Columbia, go back towards Earth, and reenter. I mean, all the things that have to go right, all of the things. 1969 technology I was just speechless at points.
Yeah, we talked about it previously, but it's like I full on broke into tears watching this documentary, and the moments that always got me were those sweeping moments when you really processed the number of human beings who dedicated so many years of their lives to make something truly extraordinary happen. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
Have you guys heard about this upcoming Ronald D. Moore series for All Mankind? You guys know about this?
Apple series. Yeah.
I'm super stoked about it. The conceit, for those who don't know, is what if we lost that space race to the moon? What if America was still hungering for the next, victory flagpole? And what if we continued to pour money into a black hole? To make extraordinary scientific achievements happen. I dig it. Ronald D. Moore, in general, really good storyteller.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see this. I think that we're getting a more – that's a good reminder. I think we're now looking more up to think of, why don't we go further and why don't we go there more? And the thing that, gets forgotten is in its era, Apollo was controversial because it was cost so much. It was such a huge part of the budget. It was not the whole world. The whole world was together on that moment that man stepped foot on the moon. But up until then, it was not. And we think we're divided today. And actually, there was an interview with Buzz Aldrin where they're talking about, today's divisions. And Buzz is like, we were in Vietnam, when this happened. we had riots on campuses and violence that today, we have issues, but not like that.
You remember in First Man, they showed that footage from the poem Whitey on the Moon. I mean, it was like there was a legitimate case to be made with what the hell are you doing going to the moon when we have these level of problems right back home?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, that's a thing that gets sort of brought up again. And, not that we want to get too much on the soapbox right now, but there is. Anytime you're pushing technology forward, particularly if it's not just building bombs, but building things like for humans and space and stuff, we see those benefits. There are millions of people alive today because of things that technologies that have come as indirect results of that, in medical technologies from things like dialysis machines and other stuff that were directly affected by these sorts of technologies. And then that's sort of the beautiful thing is, people like, why bother? It's like, well, if we set ourselves on this big goal, like going to the moon, you get these other things that come out of it. And you could just say, you could just fund that research directly, which is maybe an answer. But sometimes in trying to solve the problems of putting humans in space, you know, the human civilization is built upon the idea of allowing us to adapt and live longer in environments that are hostile to us or improving the quality of our lives. And you get those benefits. So, you know, I think, yay space. You know, but we're always going to have those discussions, but I don't know. It is, yeah, exciting.
Oh, did I see right? What, was it just over the last week or maybe over the last 2 weeks? SpaceX came out with a more detailed explanation of why that that escape module capsule exploded.
Yeah, so there's a guy who Scott Manley does really, really good YouTube videos breaking things down and explaining a lot of the. He's actually got a background in, I believe, astronomy or physics. He's super smart about this. He does really good jobs of explaining this stuff down. You should check out Scott Manley's channel. But basically what it is you have a helium pressure tank that provides pressure to push the fuel through the rocket engines. That's how you know, it's because it's not like just gravity pulls these things through. You have to have pressure. So they use helium to apply pressure to the fuels. In this case, you have a couple different combustibles to mix. And apparently one of the combustible materials worked its way back up through like a valve that wasn't supposed to go through. It was a one-way valve, but it made its way through that valve and got into this other metalwork there, which can be extremely – basically some of the combustible fuel got up in there. And so once the helium was released, it created pressure, and that fuel exploded within that valve, you know, outside of that valve, right? So they fixed it basically using valves, because these were valves meant to be reusable that you just turn them off or on, but they pulled those out and now they're putting these blast through valves that you just blow through, the one time use ones, which is what they normally use. And, you know, it's one of those things that SpaceX, you know, has made a design choice for reusability, and they're like, we're going to yank that out. You know, they've had to make a lot of choices to get away from reusability to get this thing to work, and eventually it can work them back in. But figured out what it was.
I remember at the time when we were hearing about it, of course, it was all speculation on our end. But it's like what we wanted most to hear was it was Gary. Gary forgot his Brillo pad and it exploded. But instead, it was a design problem. But from a PR perspective, they did a good job of saying it's this one thing. We've replaced all of them. Not a problem anymore. And,
it's a design issue where they tried a new design but we already have a solution that works. That's been worked well for thousands and thousands of rocket launches that we've been using for, you know, 60 years. And they said, we're going to try this different thing, which was worked great. But in this instance, they're like, no, we'll go back to the old, we'll go back to the original thing because, you know, the thing that should have worked didn't work. But that was an area they had of concern that there's maybe an issue here. And then went like, yep, nope, this is why you put things on the stand and you test them. You know, you just hope to find them earlier, not later.
Yeah.
So NASA seems satisfied. You know, the Crew Dragon's moving forward. They're going to do an in-flight abort test next, which is going to basically take off, have that capsule eject from it, and then land. And then if that tests out well and they feel satisfied, then they're going to put, you know, astronauts on board. And, you know, probably not going to happen later this year, probably be next year. You know,
the crewed flight, not the abort test.
Yeah. Oh, we're getting Scott Manley's bona fides. He has a degree in physics, astronomy, master's in computational physics. He's really qualified, folks. he's a great explainer. He's super, super qualified to explain this stuff. We also been having developments with Starship. You know, Elon Musk has said, so they've built their Starship as the next generation, you know, amazing, fully reusable. And they did a test fire of this new Raptor engine, which is a methane engine. They had a big fireball and people were like, oh, my God, it blew up. Like, nah, it's methane blowing, you know, methane blowback, but really wasn't much damage. But Elon has said that the Starship, which is actually the full stack of the full size, full stack thing, he says we may have test flights of that in 2 to 3 months.
Oh, wow. That's quick.
Holy cow.
Or 2 to 3 months after the next, to clarify that.
After it achieves orbit during the test.
Yeah, they said, orbit after that. So he's looking at trying to go orbital next year.
What was the quote that he said? It was something about regulation saying that it would quite literally, they'll be faster to actually go to Mars than to seek approval that they believe they could go to Mars.
That are working with, you know, the challenge NASA has to deal with is that you can get a presidential administration, Vice President Mike Pence, too, who are super ambitious about space going towards Mars and moon. You could not have asked for the probably the most pro that we've had in years on that. But it, you need, you know, as a democracy, as it should be, you need Congress to approve the funding for this. And that's been the challenge. And NASA can say, yes, great, we want to do this. We can make this thing happen. But we need $40 billion authorized in the next, you know, 24 months. And, you know, look at how long it takes us to reach a budget deal. You know, look at how long it takes to do these things. And maybe it's good that it I don't know. I mean, you know, because you could say like, well, you know, I don't know. But the point is that's the problem, is that it's not like NASA gets to say, well, we've got a $20 billion budget. We're going to do it for whatever we want. They're told, you know, Congress says you will spend the money on X, Y, or Z. And to get that money means a lot of horse trading. It's a, you know, it's no coincidence that your biggest NASA facilities are also, you know, where the most important people on the space sciences committees, you know, constituents live.
Yeah.
So, well, it's politics. But yeah, I think, yeah, Elon's point was like, yeah, we could probably get there fast. And part of it is it would be great for NASA to fund like Starship, to put money into program more programs like that. But it's so crazy and out there. You know, Elon Musk is like, maybe we should just go build this thing and show it works. And then, you know, they'll come knocking for that.
There does come that tipping point where all of a sudden it is profitable, not just like a non-crazy idea, but actually profitable to just go and say, hi, we're on the moon. Who wants to give us money? You know, because we can do this apparently.
Well, yeah, because there's a difference between, you know, the way that things have previously gone is, all right, let's go to these companies and let's do a made-to-order whatever. We want to do blank. Please give us that and then just hit us with the bill later. Cool. All the money in the world? We'll figure it out. Here's, you know, we'll figure out how to settle up. But, I mean, and obviously what SpaceX can offer and any of the other, you know, Blue Origin and the like is, no, this isn't, you're not funding our R&D even necessarily. You can wait until we have a functioning product and you can just say, order me up one of those that already has a set price.
But it'd be nice if you funded our R&D.
That would be nice, you know. You know, who doesn't like a little help here and there?
Well, that's so that's the next topic I want to get to, is things are expensive. And like even like AI research, right? You know, every now I've been following a lot of stuff like with voice generation and stuff. And, you know, we talked about a while ago, like Adobe had the Voco thing, which could like take 30 minutes of anybody's voice and create a really good voice model of that. And we never saw that. And part of it is that like to build that model, it takes, you know, a week worth of supercomputer training and that will improve. But it's expensive, and the costs on that are expensive and enormous. OpenAI, which was an initiative founded by a number of people, initially including Elon Musk and others, to basically be a nonprofit dedicated to researching AI, creating benevolent AI, and has been doing some exciting stuff. We've talked about a lot of OpenAI stuff. They made a big shift a couple months ago. They went from like a strict nonprofit status to a different one, which basically is sort of a semi-private, semi-profit nonprofit status, which is, you know, raised some questions about like, okay, what does this mean? And part of that is addressing the fact that for OpenAI, the problem is if recruiting, if you're trying to recruit the top artificial intelligence researchers in the world, there are a lot of wonderful opportunities with companies where you're going to get stock shares and other stuff like that, where, you know, you look like you might be participating in the next Google versus working for a nonprofit. So OpenAI shifted the way they worked, basically large part for recruitment. And now today they've announced a partnership with Microsoft, like $1 billion, million year partnership with them to develop technologies for the Azure platform, which, you know, question is, you know, is this fundamentally different than, you know, where we thought OpenAI was going, or is this really the way it has to go in order to make these things happen? You know,
I mean, one hand. I don't know. I'm left with sort of the impression where it's like, I feel like AI wants to succeed, and the method by which it succeeds is sort of immaterial to me. Like whether it goes mm-hmm. through a corporate hands or government controlled hands or independent creator hands, like eventually it still becomes sentient and starts to command humans. So,
well, sure. The one of the things that gets brought up though, is so OpenAI is working towards the idea of the AGI, the artificial general intelligence, which would, you know, the idea of that is, and we may find that this is a very far away from where we're what we need or what we want. But the idea is that And AGI is just a really is a very imagine, you know, it's a human with, you know, I'm making it like IQ of 1,000, you know, and you're like, hey, design a car. It designs you a car. Like, hey, you know, look at this, you know, figure out how to look at this, you know, the HIV virus, figure out, you know, what's and look at all these medical records, help us figure out a way to cure this. Let's have a conversation, all that. So AGI would be able to work with anything you use a human brain for, and AGI could work on, but also the idea that it would be, you know, exponentially more smart than humans are. You know, a group of AGI working on something could be like all of Google and Microsoft and National Science Foundation trying to solve a problem. And the problem is that, yes, once we have it, we have it, but we don't have it. If Google has it and Google says, hey, we got this AGI, it's damn brilliant at figuring out, you know, Bitcoin pricing for the next, next 4 weeks or whatever. It's super, super accurate at that. And then, or stock market stuff. And now the fear is among AI researchers that the person who develops the AGI will quickly amass such an economic advantage over everybody else, you know, because all of a sudden this thing can start filing patents on things that are really good patents, really good ideas on stuff, drug discovery, all this, and doing this in mass, that all of a sudden the accumulation of capital starts to go towards who has this. And that's the idea of, if, you know, the Chinese develop an AGI before us, is this good? I'm not sure that it is, because it all becomes to how people are incentivized, you know. So
that's interesting, because you bring up an idea that I don't care if a Coke or Pepsi wins, but the idea of another country, especially a country that has objectively stated its goals to, you know, supersede the United States, that does sort of that changes things.
Well, and even from a company point of view, and I mean the three of us are very much on the same page as far as what we believe in markets and things like this, is that Facebook and Google are among two of the most powerful companies in the world, right? The fear is the concern is that the company that figures out AI, like Google figured out search or Facebook figured out social, won't just be another Google or Facebook sized company. It's going to be an exponentially bigger company than them and growing faster. And the things that we worry about now with, and I think a lot of it's irrational, but the things we worry about with them become even faster. And, you know, and I don't know, I'm trying to be a fear monger here or whatever, but I don't want to be the person that just goes, meh, they're just, you know, exaggerating the problem or whatever. Cause we don't effing know. You know, every week you find new artificial intelligence papers and you see stuff where computers do things like, oh, wow, we thought that was totally undoable 20 years ago. You know, like, and then we go like, it's not happening fast enough. But damn, if, you know, my voice assistants are really smart now at understanding more complex questions and stuff. So,
yeah, I have a similar thought about automation, or at least I have a parallel thought to that in that, like, you know, we talk about, like, you know, a long-term economy where there are less jobs because automation and new mechanical technologies make it so we need less people to make or produce the same things. And at least for me, you know, one of my concerns is, like, the technology that goes into place to enable those new, I don't know, societal systems are going to be owned by the people who run these companies, and I don't know that will necessarily spread out to all of the people. I know it's not necessarily just that jobs are gone, but that there's still no incentive, there's still profit motive incentives in that system. And so I think the AI thing is a very similar concern, where, you know, you suddenly need less people, but there's still not a lot of incentives to make
dividends
to society.
It's a valid thing, you know, having just spent some time in India, where, you know, the expression, I forgot who it was, it said, you know, the future's here, it's just unevenly distributed. And I felt that, you know, I felt that, like, you know, and the benefits that I feel here in my Burbank apartment or home in Florida or wherever, you know, there, or living in a nice environment, all that. But I go half a mile and I see people who don't experience that, or I go around the world and it's like, don't you know, the future's here, we have solutions for all these things, but for whatever reasons it's not evenly distributed. And then that's the big question of course, you know, like, we have this wonderful system that'll work now for redistribution, and maybe it doesn't work, but it doesn't mean that we should ignore the question. And then I think Bryce, like, yeah, like, what happens when we're talking about $1 trillion of wealth?
Yeah.
And I think that that's the fear with both AI and automation, is that, like, once that dog is off the leash, is there any catching it? Like, yeah. And for automation, it's like, okay, well, once you replace certain key sectors of our economy with, you know, self-driving cars or other technology that is already kind of here, just not at the level that it would need to be, where does that go? You know, like, I mean, it certainly is never coming back. Like, what happens in a world where we've already seen certain sectors just totally die because we've seen a technological change? What happens if we see 3 or 4 of them within 10 years? And then what happens if the AI that's behind it, there's like, no, we become so dependent so fast, and there are, you know, hell, you compared this to Google and Facebook, Andrew, and it's like, there's no shortage of Google and Facebook employees that complain about the same things that we complain about with Google and Facebook, but it's like, we can't do anything. The machine's too big, and that's just a bunch of humans, let alone having so much of their jobs taken over by the, you know, decision-making robots that are making the right decisions.
Yeah. I'm excited about it, and I think that, you know, the greatest age of humanity may be upon us, and it is that you know, we move towards what we're incentivized towards. You know, when we started, you know, this American experiment, one of the things that's built into our country is the idea of checks and balances, you know, and that's why, you know, we've despite what the headline said, we've avoided tyranny because there's checks for power and stuff. But when you talk about, you know, this thing that, and I have friends who are like, oh, it's overblown. People worried about atomic energy like this, and they worried about all that. They said this was the thing. And it's like, yeah, but the people giving the warnings back then weren't the ones as deeply involved as the people working on it. And when it's the people building AIs are really, really worried, you know, that's a thing where I'm like,
yeah,
what?
That was what Wired magazine said about the Y2K bug. It's like, unlike previous doomsday scenarios, the people who are worried about the Y2K bug are the engineers who know the most about the Y2K bug. So I don't know that particular argument holds much sway with me.
Did we do nothing about Y2K, or did we rewrite tons of code about Y2K?
I'm just saying that particular argument that, but this time it's the smart people who are worried.
Yeah,
I've heard that before.
The problem with the analogy of the Y2K bug was we did a lot of stuff to mitigate that. And I don't know that did we need to rewrite software for 727s? Did we need to rewrite healthcare database stuff? Did we need to not do that? I'm not going to make that argument that we didn't need to do that, but also, like, you know, the Y2K bug was a thing that we, you know, was like 3 years before nobody cared about, the RV, you know, 4 years, then it became this big thing. And there was an industry of people trying to prey upon those fears. That was part of it, though, was the people that the big part of the fear was coming from, like, oh, I know this. This is why you need to hire my company to solve your Y2K problem. People were incentivized towards the fear. And here, some of the people who are the biggest advocates are the ones incentivized towards R&D of this, not because they're saying we're going to mitigate it and stop it, but they're like, well, we're working on it, but I don't know.
Well,
I don't know.
No one does. No one does. The first person to know will be the AI that tells us.
Yeah, exactly. The Superintelligence, the book by
Nick Bostrom.
Nick Bostrom. Yeah, it's really. I recommend it if you're interested in the topic. I have Mr. Bostrom, all right, you know, I think you're wrong about this, but I
think you tend to soft sell your recommendation of reading that book. Previously you've mentioned that, like, if you're into wonkiness, go for it, but I think it stands on its own. I really enjoyed it. I think people should read it full stop, just so you're familiar with stuff like the paperclip argument.
I agree. Because he's got it is a wonderful, and I was just trying to say that, like, despite my kind of like, meh, I'm like, no, read the book. It's like The Martian. I'm like, there's no windstorms on Mars, but it's a great, inspiring book. You know, right. I've met people at NASA who read The Martian and became botanists at NASA. And so I could be like, man, the science is this. And it's like, yeah, well, people were inspired and did real things. What have you done, Andrew? Put on some plastic armor and played with sharks?
Yeah, I guess it's not so much a recommendation so much as an announcement that it's required reading. If you intend to have a have a position in the AI debate, you got to read Superintelligence.
Yeah.
Yep. Agreed. Do we want to I just wonder, do you see the thing about AI portraits that came out today?
No.
It's this new website. Hold on. I'm going to load it up. AIportraits.com. Wait, is this a face app thing? Should we not be using AI portraits?
Oh, no. This is North Korean developers. Nothing to do with the Russians. Oh, you're fine.
North Korean? No.
But this is similar to face app. You upload a portrait and, oh, man, it's taking a long time to load, probably because it's being
Although cloudy. Here, well, Bryce, while you pull that up, if the North Korean government, and it was listed in the Apple store as like the People's Republic of Korea, we have made an app where you can put Kim Jong-un's haircut on your dog. Like,
oh, wait, what is this? Hold on. What's it called?
Brian? It would immediately, but you have to give us permission for like your camera, your microphone, like all data. Please leave this app on at all times or we'll immediately delete all of your cute dog photos. People would do it. Like the power of the meme in our modern world is amazing.
From the visuals I'm seeing, is AI portraits like you upload a photo and it makes what looks like a painting portrait of your photo?
Yeah, in like a classical sort of portrait style. So I don't know how well it works with multiple people, but I've found this image of the family here.
Oh, there you go.
I'm going to upload and see what it
with
does.
With Kepler doing a derp face.
Oh, yeah. And so this is AIportraits.com. It works well on the phone, too. I've used this on the phone. I always look bad in it. I think it always draws me bad. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's the portraits problem.
So what they did is they put thousands and thousands of classical portraits in there. And so the AI built up a model of what a classic portrait looks like. And then you have the input for a photo to say, this is the, you start with the photo. This is what you want to end up with. So then what it does is it tries to basically create a portrait, you know, based upon that photo. And one of the things I made this point before, but almost all of the, yeah.
Mine kind of looked like that too.
Most of the AI stuff we see right now uses 2D images to sort of to create like 2D portraits and stuff because it doesn't understand it's looking at 3D objects or whatever, only from what it can infer from that. But as we start having more computing power and we start to increase that, as AI starts to process 3D images and 3D data sets and stuff, you're going to see scary, amazing things start to happen as it starts processing volumetric data. And, and that's, we're a couple, Moore's Law clicks away from that becoming a practical thing, but it's exciting. So, All right, picks.
I got a pick. It's literally anything but The Lion King.
Fight about The Lion King. Go.
we'll talk about it on Cord Killers, but it's
spoiling
but
time.
Spoiler.
No, on this show, I don't listen to Cord Killers. Fight about it now.
I mean, look, it's the problem with Christian rock is that it apes the style of cutting edge art. But at its heart has so much respect for the core narrative that it dare not take an interesting artistic risk. So as a result, all Christian rock songs are, guess what? Spoiler alert. Hooray for God. And that is what I felt during all of The Lion King. I hated it. I hated it beyond words.
It was a deep biting moment.
Like, you dare not change and make anything interesting. They made two very small changes. Billy Eichner and Seth Rogen were very, very fun and interesting.
Sure.
They were the only redeeming aspects of that entire garbage fire of a movie.
I started crying halfway through The Circle of Life at the very beginning of the movie. And then continued to cry three more times in the film.
Today's opposite day. You're taking the Brian role.
I think this is a marketing problem, honestly, for The Lion King. I think the fact that they kept putting out this clip of Hakuna Matata, which is this fun, cartoony song, when they've kind of tried to do... We were talking about this before we turned the stream on, but they kind of do like Meerkat Manor, right? Try to make a show out of just footage of animals.
Right.
And I think that's the aesthetic of this, right? It's trying to be realistic to try to get rid of all of the human sort of elements to it. And so that's why it's not like big expressive faces and stuff like that.
I will vouch for the fact that they succeeded in making an emotive narrative come through, not from facial expressions, but from postural expressions, right?
And as a part of that, like, you know, you notice the things that they changed, and the most of the things that they changed are things that they took out, right? So like, Be Prepared is way shorter; it's like a minute long. They like Rafiki, you know, I think like the whole scene of like Rafiki hitting Simba with the stick, like that doesn't even happen. I think it's different, but I don't know. I bought into the look of it. I don't think it's perfect. I think there are a lot of problems. I don't think that Donald Glover and Beyonce are great in their roles. And I also think it's okay. This is one very specific issue. Maybe we can meet eye to eye on this.
Okay.
I think it's very weird to put a new song in the movie that is sung by Beyonce, who does a character in the movie, in this movie where all the characters are singing, and it's not her character singing the song.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
The new song Spirit, that when Simba is on his way back to Pride and he meets up with Nala,
right,
at the end of that scene, it's Beyonce singing that song, who is Nala at that point.
Didn't track any of that.
I just thought it was like the weirdest decision to make. And I also missed the They Call Me Mr. Pig. I was really upset they didn't have a good replacement for that. But otherwise, I thought you know, it was visually really impressive. A good film, not a masterpiece.
Felt like going to church. I sat there. I've heard this sermon a million effing times before. Man. I couldn't wait for it to be over. So,
man, that wasn't as good of a fight. I wanted Joel to
fight. It's because we know we have to have it again in 2 hours.
This is warm up.
This undercard. You guys are just sparring with each other.
Kirkkillers.com. You'll see that this week.
This was my pick last week. It's my pick again this week because I watched a lot more of it. Euphoria on HBO. It is certainly teen exploitation, like as in everything that you've ever been warned about that these teens are doing. It is all a plot line on this show, but the cinematography is great. And it is a real great example of a show that is constantly giving its characters something to do. Things that matter, things that are interesting. And it's actually kind of made me think more and more about like the construct of why high school shows are always important, like or are popular. We want to keep visiting high school dynamics, even if they are, you know, cranked up to a kind of beyond parody point, which Euphoria kind of often is. But well done. It's certainly, compared to some other shows that involve teenagers that came out on Netflix that involve other dimensions, you know, not to say that everything has to be about screwing and doing drugs like Euphoria is, but man, do they all have internal motivations that they seek to continue to resolve on an episode-by-episode basis.
I think there's so many teen shows on Netflix, it took me about a minute to realize he meant Stranger Things.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, like, you know, Sex Education is another one that, like, is obviously, you know, a bunch of 27-year-olds having sex and pretending that they're in high school. But even that show was a little bit, it wore some of its, like, very special episode stuff on its sleeve in a way that Euphoria doesn't, which is interesting, A, in that it's like you can't be too much like, what are we doing every time that you're trying to tell this kind of dirty or grittier story. But it is always, no matter what, all the central points of every character are about relationships to other characters and not necessarily, oh my God, we're totally lost in this other weird sub thing. Mm-hmm.
Is Euphoria done? Have they had their season finale yet?
No, two more episodes. I just checked today, and for the record, I am up on everything but the episode that aired last night.
Last night.
But cool. Yeah, well done.
I have a pick beyond the Lion King. Over the weekend, I got into this new card game, and I was originally kind of
pronounced Hearthstone. Hearthstone.
When I was hesitant about it because I heard a lot of good stuff about it, and I did spend a little bit of time with Hearthstone back a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Growing up, I spent time with Pokemon and Yu-Gi-Oh and Magic, and I think the thing that I don't like multiplayer games very much, right? Like, certainly not online multiplayer games. And so I think all of those card games, they're all multiplayer. Now Hearthstone is all online and stuff. And so I have a hard time keeping up with the competitive nature of those things. And so I have actually really found a good single player experience out of this it's like 6 months old. This game, Slay the Spire. And it is a roguelike card game. And so a little similar to like the arena mode in Hearthstone, you pick one of these three heroes, and as you make your way up this tower, each floor is usually like there's either a card battle, or sometimes you'll have a little like a adventure game like choice, or you'll go to a shop, or you have to rest or something. And as you go with your run, you have a certain deck that you start off with of a few cards, and each battle you gain more cards. And I actually finally beat it over the weekend, and it was like an hour or an half or so for the run, the full run. And it was really interesting because it lets you, like, the thing with Hearthstone is, you know, you can do combos and you can really build your deck to do certain things. And with this, because you're constantly remaking the deck and you are so well used to, you know, a pool of like 70 cards or so per character, you can do some really crazy stuff. So, like, there are relics that give you, like, buffs and do weird stuff. And there was this one that I got that gives you confusion for just, you will always have confusion, but you get an extra energy or something. And confusion randomizes all of the card values. So you can just do whatever in your deck because you're not going to know what anything costs. And so it lets you make weird choices like that. I really enjoyed it. It's very cool. I think you would like it, Brian.
Cool. And it's called what?
It's called Slay the Spire.
It's
on the Nintendo Switch, which I'm playing it, but it's also on PC and a bunch of other places. I think it's really cool. And as someone who likes those card games but doesn't like spending time to get another person involved to play,
sure.
I think it's really cool.
Very cool. What about you, Andrew?
So I have some interviews coming up this week that I got to do for the Shark Week thing. And you know, and talk about, like, I did this thing. And they have, granted, I mean, the you know, clip package where you're with great white sharks is kind of an awesome clip package to happen. I'll have. But I decided I was going to make an experience, and one to sort of show people when I do interviews, like, hey, this is what it's like. What it's like to be with great white sharks is one of the things that I was taught was with great whites is they can see when you're looking at them. And when you're down there, you got to keep eye contact with, you know, like I had like a dozen at a time, and you got to look around and see each one and let each one know that you see them, and they keep away. When they don't think you're paying attention is when they come up behind you and they're ambush hunters, ambush predators. And there were multiple occasions where I had sharks sneaking up behind me because they didn't think I was paying attention, and I had to turn around really fast and you know, give them a stern go away shark version underwater that you do. But anyhow, so I went and I used a framework called A-Frame, which is a web VR framework for the browser. And I made an experience that works in the Oculus Quest. It works in VR. And if you go to actually ghostdiver.xyz, you can see this, and there's a video playing of this. And so what it is you're underwater, and when you have your controllers, your right hand is a shield and your left hand has a flashlight. So if you go into night mode, you can try to spot the great whites before they sneak up on you. Probably best in day mode. Night mode has been, some people describe it as very triggering and terrifying, myself included.
Looking at this video, it's total darkness. It's insane.
Yeah, so you can go to there. If you look in your browser, you'll see what it looks like during day mode, and you're not going to be able to control or protect yourself because you need the controllers to sort of raise the shield. But that shark, I built a very simple, not even AI, just a very simple kind of like logic for the sharks that was similar to how they behave. Now, granted, sharks can also surprise you and do things that all of a sudden they decide they're going to behave differently. So you go there and you can, with the controllers inside, like your Oculus or your Vive or whatever, you click on one button, it'll start to add sharks. You click on another button, which is the blank mode, where it'll remove sharks. And then if you get really brave, you click night mode and all you have is a flashlight and the shark's going to come see you and say hello.
Oh, they got us.
Yeah, it's even better. He didn't eat you. He just passed you. He just sort of violated your space. But when he eats you, it's really fun. And I put some sound effects and stuff in there from like Jaws and stuff. And you get like a doll's eyes. There's some Quint stuff in there. So personally speaking, I find it terrifying. I find this can be – this is more frightening to me than my actual experience with Grey Whites.
So that is ghostdiver.xyz?
Yeah, free if you have a Quest or you have an Oculus Rift or Vive, whatever, it should work. I think it should work on those other – I know it tested on the Quest, but you know, I built that as sort of a fun – and kind of a cool thing. It's just a showcase for the technology. Like, it only took me like 2 days to put together a fun, terrifying experience using, you know, this framework A-Frame and a little bit of JavaScript.
Nice.
And some cool models and stuff by other people, which are credited in the notes there. So ghostdiver.xyz. There's a video there. I should put up some more videos, but anyhow, I need to get the, you know, having you or Brian playing that and recording yourselves. That's what I want, the video. So cool. Guess that's all. Guess it's everything. Guess it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.